Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Here in the Northern Rockies, dark winter months are outlasted in basements, dens, and nooks where kindred souls gather together to share intel, swap fly patterns, and relive the memories from seasons past. This gathering spot, known locally as the February Room, is the inspiration for this podcast. No matter the season, the door is always open to those with a fly fishing story to tell. Brought to you by CD Fishing USA, the North American distributor for composite development fly rods and accessories. 40 years of Kiwi ingenuity and graphite technology now available at cd-fishing.us or your local CD USA dealer. Follow us on Instagram, YouTube, and Facebook. And remember to go fishing. Here's your host, the Carnops, and this is the February Room.
As any honest fishing guide will tell you, the days and faces tend to blend together. Lost in the ether between cleaning coolers, fixing boats, tying flies, and prepping meals. But then there are those days that stand out from the rest, whether from exceptionally good or bad rapport with a client, an unexpected occurrence, or exceptional fishing. And the most memorable days contain elements of all three. And I've never forgotten a particular day I had many years ago during the salmon fly hatch on the Blackfoot. To my delight, my guest hadn't forgotten it either, as I discovered when we reunited at the BHA rendezvous earlier this summer in Missoula. Ray Penny, welcome to the February Room.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you. And, I got to thank you again for taking the time to seek me out at the rendezvous. That meant a lot to me, man. It was really cool that you recalled that day as I did. It was one of those things like, man, I saw you there and I'm like, gosh, I know that guy. How do I know that guy? And I was trying to put it together. And then lo and behold, one of my buddies came up to me and said, hey, the guy over at G&H Decoys, I'm sending him over here. He asked me if I remembered a fishing guide by the name of Justin. So that's how this all came to pass, man. Yeah, that was super cool of you.
It was a totally weird thing. I was talking to this guy and, I was just, we were up there for rendezvous. I hadn't been to Montana since the last time I saw you, which I think I was doing the math after we talked, and I think it was like 16 years ago. And
if we were young.
Yeah, talking to this guy, and I was saying, hey, can you give me some, you got any local tips you're willing to give up here for a guy who wants to maybe fish a little bit while he's out here? And, I know the runoff's bad right now, but, where could I maybe go find a fish somewhere? And he was saying, well, where have you been? And I said, well, I came up here once, and last time I was in Montana, man, I just had a bang-up day during the salmon fly hatch here on the Blackfoot. And he's like, oh, who did you fish with? And I said, oh, you probably don't know him. A guy named Justin Carnop. And he turns around and he points at you who were standing down the way. And he said, you mean that guy right down there? And I was like, holy crap. And it was, it was one of the best days of fishing of my whole life. I came out there because I was hosting a trip for a group of people. And we were over there at the Blue Damsel Lodge. And the owner of the Blue Damsel, Keith Radabaugh, we had an odd number of people. So I was going to end up fishing on my own. And he said, hey, I got a great guide for you. I think you're really going to like this guy. And so you and I met, and I seem to recall on the drive up there talking, you were talking about Oklahoma and all this stuff, and you were like, Oklahoma bass. And you said, we got bass. Do you want to go catch largemouth for a day? And so we ended up getting down to the, you know, to the Blackfoot, and we ended up, I remember the salmon flies were just bananas, crazy. Thickest hatch of insects I think I've ever seen, just flying all over the place. And I got in the boat with you, and I kind of like you mentioned in the intro, guys are always, you know, a little initially skeptical of the client when they first get in the boat, like, you know, who is this guy and who do I have today? And are we going to have a good day or a bad day? And you told me, you know, go cast it back in that corner. And I made the cast, and then you gave me a little more complicated cast, and you said, okay, go put it over there. And I ended up putting the fly where you wanted it. And after about the third one of those, you looked at me and you said, all right, you said, you can throw a fly rod. I think we're going to have a good day. And we did, man. We had a fan-friggin-tastic day. And I think I remember, my recollection is that we caught something like, I think we caught close to 30 fish that day. We caught 28 fish or something. One of them was a really big brown trout that I managed to hook right before a big rapid. And you had to manage the boat through the rapid. And I was freaking out like, oh my gosh, is this fish going to come unbuttoned while we go through this rapid? And it was sort of like a rolling catastrophe until we finally got through the rough water. And you beached the boat, and we actually got out of the boat to land the fish and get pictures of it. But I'll never forget that. It was not just one of the best days of fishing that I've ever had, but you know, the time that I had with you was one of the best guide experiences that I've ever had fishing with a guide, and I'll always remember it.
Well, that's awesome, man. Yeah, the stars aligned. It was just that perfect combination of you know, like you said, a bug hatch that just doesn't happen very often on the Blackfoot. So, like, you know, there's salmon flies on the Blackfoot for about a month, but there's only those little windows when there's enough of them to really get the fish's attention and the big fish in the river. And, you know, of angler skill, of course, because you're obviously you're an extremely good fly angler. And then, you know, we had it firing on all cylinders, having fun, telling jokes, laughing. And yeah, it just all came together. And I'll never forget that brown, and where you hooked that brown is, you know, ever since, every time that I'm fishing the Blackfoot during the salmon fly hatch, right, my spidey senses go up as we approach that spot, but never again have I had a brown of that size come up and eat a salmon fly in that same spot. But I always anticipate it from that day,
yeah.
Which is super cool. So
yeah,
that was man, perfect storm,
great memory. And you know, for a flatlander like me, who doesn't, you know, we've got some trout here in Oklahoma, but it's all put and take, and I don't even bother with it anymore. I don't think I've fished for. In fact, I went out the other day striper fishing in one of the rivers that's got trout in it. And I happened to incidentally catch a trout, a very aggressive trout that ate a big size 2 Clouser minnow. And, but other than that, I haven't trout fished in Oklahoma in maybe a decade, because when you go and you have those experiences with guys like you and places like the Blackfoot, and it's not just the fishing, it's like the whole ecosystem. It's all of it together. When you come, and I'm not trying to put down my own state's trout fishing, but it's just not the same here. So for a flatlander like me to go up and have an experience like that in a place like Montana, that's the story that I'll be telling, the fishing story I'll be telling my great grandkids when I'm an old man who can't get out of the chair.
Yeah. Well, that's awesome, man. You know, since then, the Blackfoot is still a beautiful river and it still can fish well, but it's gotten so much more crowded than it was in those days. So, even if you did come back to fish it again during the salmon fly hatch, you might be a little bit taken aback, just by the amount of traffic that we have now, on that river.
Well, I'd like to try it. I'm going to look at my calendar and see if I can and get out there. And if you've got a free day, I'll pay for the gas and the beer, and maybe let's find a chance to go get back out on the water again.
Yeah. Well, that's absolutely, the boat's always open for you. You know, you can still have really good fishing on it. You just gotta find those kind of shoulder season times, sure, when the tourists aren't here. There's been there's a new resort up there since you've been here, that puts a lot of pressure on that river as well. So yeah, but it can still fish really well. In fact, just a few years ago, in you know, May during kind of runoff, there's some periods where the river will dip. And if you can hit one of those, you can find those big fish. And then, you know, back in like in April, and then again in, you know, October, November, when everyone's kind of gone, and the big fish do come back out to play, and you can kind of have the place to yourself. But, yeah. And in fact, just a number of years ago, I caught the biggest brown I've ever caught on the Blackfoot. So they're still in there. They just kind of hide during the peak summer season, and not just due to the angling pressure, but there's just so many more boaters and tubers and rafters. You know, they've put a series of campgrounds on the river, and so now folks come that are just looking to raft and which is, you know, all fine and dandy, but sure. it's just more activity that spooks the fish, right? So yeah. They just kind of they adjust accordingly. Well, cool. Well, you already kind of told a fishing story, but the floor is yours if you got another one for us.
Yeah. So I guess my most recent trip, and I love trout fishing. I love having experiences like that one on the Blackfoot. But, you know, over the years, my real passion has become tarpon fishing. And there's just something unique about a big predator like that, that you can see, that you're sight fishing to. And there's just something... this is probably going to make me sound like a sociopath, but there's something kind of violent about tarpon that appeals to me. There's nothing subtle or gentle about a tarpon at all. They eat and then they come flying out of the water, and then they're going to do everything in their power. I mean, you know, there's a real responsibility, I think, that comes with it too, because you got to handle that fish really ethically, because it will kill itself to get free from you. It's a fish that's willing to literally go to its death to avoid having you drag it up next to the boat. And there's just something that appeals to me about it. I happened to go to, after rendezvous, my mom's family's all from Puerto Rico. So we went back to Puerto Rico to go visit some family that we hadn't seen since before COVID. And I had a chance to get out actually and tarpon fish with Dr. Keenan Adams, one of the BHA board members from the National Board of Directors. And Keenan was gracious enough to take me to his honey hole. And we were catching tarpon and snook. We saw some really big snook, you know, snook as thick around as your leg. And we saw these big tarpon that were kind of rolling out in the middle of the channel that we were fishing. And I started to make a couple of casts, and I just had an 8-weight because we were only in for, you know, baby tarpon and for snook. And these tarpon were rolling out in the channel, and I made a couple of casts, and Keenan said, "Man," he said, "don't waste your time." He said, "For whatever reason in this channel, those fish out there in the middle, it's big fish, and they won't even give you the time of day. It's a waste of your time." And so I'm a pretty stubborn guy, and like the number one way to get me to do something is to tell me that it's a waste of time, which is probably evidenced by my current professional life. But I started casting to these fish. Instead of trying to chase rollers, I just sat there in my kayak. We were in two separate kayaks. And I just sat
in the kayak. You guys were just you're DIY fishing primarily.
Oh yeah, yeah. We were not, we didn't have a boat. We were in kayaks in some of this sort of mangrove backwater there in a spot that Keenan's got. And, so I just sat there and waited for a little while. And you know, I decided instead of moving around and trying to chase rollers and figure out where they're going to roll next, I'll just sit here. Somebody's bound to roll near me in the next 20 minutes. And I ended up having to wait like 10 or 15 minutes. And I finally saw this big fish roll and, cast it to her. And hooked up with her, and you know that undoubtable tarpon hook set where you know there's a fish there because the line just stops and then suddenly starts to go the other direction. And for an 8-weight, she was a pretty big fish. I think the fish was probably between 60 and 65 pounds. I've and that's not my own assessment. I've shown the picture to people that I trust, and they say, yeah, that's probably a 60 to 65 pound fish. Which is a lot for an 8-weight. And, it was a heck of a fight. And, that fish drug me around the channel, and, Keenan was gracious enough to get a little video of me doing it too. But, it was funny. He's such a nice guy. Keenan's such a friendly and nice guy. And he said, you know, I've been out here a bunch of times and I've tried to catch those fish that are rolling like that out in the big water, and I can't make them do it. And, he said, I'm really surprised, but really happy for you to see you do this. And so it was just kind of a cool thing to, to get out there and catch a fish of that size on light tackle like that. And I can't get enough tarpon. As soon as I'm financially able, I'm gonna hopefully move out of Oklahoma someday and go someplace where I can catch tarpon 365 days a year, because it's totally gotten a hold of me. I don't know how to describe it. I've got the worst tarpon fever in the world.
Oh man, well, you and me both. As soon as I'm financially able, I'm gonna do the same thing.
Yeah, it's there's just something, and the other part of it is, I like four seasons and all that, but I love the idea of being able to wear shorts and a t-shirt every day of the year. And you know, that fishery, yeah, there's some seasonal change to tarpon fishery, but you can almost always, I think in the right places, you can almost always find some backwater fish to help you scratch your itch if you're in the right places. So,
yeah, you don't hear a lot about, at least I don't hear a lot about Puerto Rico. I've, had a few friends that have gone there and fished a little bit. Yeah. So is that a place where tarpon fishing is somewhat prevalent now, or can you head out there and kind of find some water to yourself still, or what's your assessment of that? Yeah. How long has it been since you've been there?
Puerto Rico this was the first time I'd been in a few years. It's kind of a conflicted place. It's a United States Commonwealth, a territory. It has a Department of Natural Resources. There's a lot of good people, I think, working in the Department of Natural Resources, but they're short on resources themselves. So the fisheries don't always get the management, I think, that they probably deserve. There's also, tarpon are eaten for food in Puerto Rico. I mean, almost anything that swims is eaten for food still. People are still, gillnet and bonefish and doing all kinds of things that I think most of us in the sport fishing world think are uncivilized. I struggle with that because I have some Puerto Rican heritage. And so on the one hand, of course, I want there to be bonefish and tarpon available for everybody all the time to be able to go catch with a fly rod. But at the same time, like, I have a lot of family there still that eat those fish. And that's been a way of life for those people for a long time. And I struggle sometimes with the value of going and saying, like, hey, these fish should only become available to sportsmen who are going to catch them on a rod and reel. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's tricky. I'm sure there's a sustainable balance in there where Puerto Ricans can still eat the fish that they're culturally accustomed to. And sportsmen can still get out and have a robust experience. But Puerto Rico is not on anybody's radar as a big time fishing destination. And I think it's just because there's not a lot of infrastructure there. Things are a little more costly in Puerto Rico than they are kind of in the rest of the Caribbean. Because it's a United States territory. I mean, you get some nice parts about it. It's, I know there's spots in Mexico you can go fish, but you kind of have to look over your shoulder for the cartel. You don't have that experience in Puerto Rico because the United States Coast Guard is all over the island. But at the same time, things cost a little bit more. Puerto Rico's had a bad run of bad luck in the last few years with earthquakes and hurricanes. So there's just not a lot of, I think there's three guys on the entire island that advertise themselves as fly guides. And for I guess whatever reason, it's just never taken off as a destination. I'm okay with that.
Right.
Because if you know the spots and you speak the language and you've got good connections, there's a ton of great places to go fish. You just got to be willing to drive off some ugly dirt roads and, wade a long ways sometimes, but if you can get into the spots, there's a lot of great fishing. You just gotta know where to go.
So yeah, so it's kind of a great spot for a DIY kind of adventure trip, it sounds like.
Absolutely. There's not a fly shop on the island, so you better before we went, I was up tying flies like crazy for a week trying to get ready, because you can't. It's not one of these things where you can go with like four of a pattern that you think is going to work. You better have 12 of a pattern that you think of every pattern. Because you get there and, you break off enough fish or you hang enough flies in the mangroves. You get down to like your last fly and you're like, man, how am I? Unless you brought the tying materials with you, you're kind of on your own. You can't just run down to the fly store and go get some more. But if you want a DIY experience, and the flip side of it that's great is It's safe. They take American dollars. Enough Puerto Ricans speak English that you don't have to speak Spanish to get around the island. There's a lot of cool non-fishing things to see. You know, if you've got, I know, you know, your wife, like mine, enjoys fishing as much as you do, it looks like. But if you've got non-fishing companions or small kids that want to have non-fishing things to do, there's plenty to see and do there. But yeah, you just got to kind of know your way around. If you ever want to go, might be a fun trip to go down there. And just, I've never gone on a strictly fishing trip down there. I've always been down there to see family and do all that. But it might be fun to block off like maybe 4 or 5 days and just go hit all the spots.
Oh man, I would love to go do that. When was the last time you were there, Ray?
So this last summer, and then before that, it had been over 10 years. It was 2011. The last time I had a chance to go, I spent some time in the Marine Corps between when you and I saw each other last, and I went to Afghanistan in 2011 and came back from Afghanistan and spent 2 weeks down there, just Maggie and I. So it had been almost, I guess just over a decade since I had been down there. And, the island has changed a lot, some for the better, some for the worse, but, the fishing I think is still mostly there. It's still mostly intact.
So was that Hurricane Maria that devastated the island?
Yeah, it was Maria that devastated the island. And then, kind of mixed with that, there was, a couple of earthquakes. And the damage from Maria and the damage from the earthquakes are all still there. You know, there's a lot of, the church that my mother, made her first communion in Ponce, big, beautiful church, several hundred years old, you know, built during Spanish colonial time. That church was kind of like a family mainstay for us, you know, and it's a place where a lot of important things had happened for our family. The earthquake was, I think all that happened in, gosh, if I'm not wrong, like 2017, and the church is still closed.
Wow.
And, there's, you know, it's been kind of a disaster, in a kind of a perpetual disaster state. Actually, I think the hurricane was 2017. I'm probably getting the dates wrong. But all of that has kind of happened in the last 5 years, and there's still a lot of infrastructure that's not been rebuilt and things that are still, shut down, in Puerto Rico, but people are kind of making the most of it. I think, you know, I was at my aunt's house and just asking her about the whole thing after Hurricane Maria. And when we, you know, you think about hurricanes hitting the U.S. Down on the Gulf Coast and so forth. And like, I have family down in Texas and they're like, oh my gosh, we didn't have power for 5 days. My aunt in Puerto Rico didn't have power for over 6 months.
Wow.
Like no electricity in her house for 6 months.
Probably no cell phone, nothing. They didn't have water in a lot of places or anything, right? I mean, it was just kind of.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. For I think she told us that for like 2 months, if she wanted water, she had to get plastic jugs and drive someplace and go fill up the jugs at a place where somebody had water. You know, I think fortunately Puerto Ricans helped Puerto Ricans and everybody looked out for each other. And most folks, you know, made it through. The culture is very generous there, but they did not have a, you know, the most interesting part of it has been you drive down the streets and you look at the power lines and people were so desperate to get power that people were just rigging it themselves.
Wow.
And so there's this like series of this like mesh, mangled mesh of wires on these posts.
Holy
in a regular neighborhood, in like a middle-class suburban neighborhood. You know, the kind of middle-class suburban neighborhood you would expect to see in a city like Dallas. And there's this like mesh of electrical wires where people got so tired of waiting for the utility to come hook up their electricity that they found somebody who knew how to do it and just ran their own line. It's kind of crazy.
Wow. That takes ingenuity and cojones too.
Yeah, absolutely. Cojones. That's the right way to put it.
Well, cool. So, but did you grow up in Puerto Rico or did you grow up in the States?
I didn't. I grew up actually living. I was born in Miami. I lived in Houston as a kid for a while. And then my dad had a job in the oil field that took us to Venezuela for some years. And so we lived in Venezuela for 7 years. We lived in Argentina for a year. And then I came back to the States to finish high school and go off to college. And so I, you know, I had a really interesting childhood. And I like, you know, I've caught a lot of largemouth bass, especially considering myself a native Texan and now an Okie transplant. But I caught peacock bass before I ever caught largemouth bass.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And My dad was he's a big time hardware angler. He likes bait casters and big plugs and all that stuff. And, you know, I got into fly fishing, sort of in my very early 20s and decided that, you know, I was going to, you know, do something different than what my old man did. Everybody wants to rebel against their dad and do something different. You know, my dad never showed me how cool this fly fishing stuff was. And now I've got kids of my own, and my sons have turned into the most diehard hardware guys in the world. I can't force them to pick up a fly rod.
Yeah.
So I guess that's just the way of the world.
So did you fish when you were in Venezuela and Argentina as well as a kid?
We did. We were only in Argentina for like a year. And I didn't get a ton of opportunities to fish while we were there. That was a really quick year. But in Venezuela, my dad sort of did the work and made a lot of contacts. And we used to go to a lake called Camatagua in Venezuela on a regular basis. It was like an hour and a half from the city of Caracas where we lived. And my dad is, you know, all American trailer trash from Ada, Oklahoma. But he spoke enough Spanish that, you know, he started to kind of explore it and DIY it himself and made contact with some local guys down there near this lake who would take us out fishing, you know, in aluminum John boats. And he became the guy at his company when they wanted to do client entertainment, like, oh, you know, his name is Ray. He's Ray Sr. He used to say, you know, Ray Sr.'s got a great spot. He can take you to his peacock bass spot. And so my dad used to be kind of the client entertainment guy for his company. He took a lot of people down there to Camatagua, and I got to tag along as a kid. We did, you know, we went offshore a fair amount too. You know, the price of gasoline was like, I'm not exaggerating, it was like 10 cents a gallon, I think, when we lived there for gasoline. And so going offshore was not an expensive experience. And so we would go offshore from time to time with some friends of my dad's. And so I had some pretty cool experiences as a very young kid that I think a lot of kids don't get. But I didn't get, you know, like, I don't think I caught maybe I caught some trout when I was like 6 or 7 years old before we moved overseas. But I didn't really go trout fishing. Until I was almost 20. I think I was 18 or 19 before I really went rainbow trout fishing in the United States. So I kind of got all my experiences backwards.
Yeah, I was going to say, nowadays all the folks that grew up trout fishing and are accustomed to trout fishing want to go do all the stuff that you got to experience first.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, it was a great childhood. I'm really fortunate to have lived that way. I want to give those experiences to my kids as soon as I can get an opportunity to do it.
Yeah, man, that's a really that's an interesting childhood you had for sure. And then, so as you mentioned, when we met, you were hosting a trip, and you were working for Orvis at the time. So how did you turn your love of fly fishing into that career? How'd that come to pass?
Yeah, that's a good question. I was after college. I went to go work for some family friends at a manufacturer's representative business, and I was selling industrial fiberglass grating up and down the Texas coast. And so, because I was traveling up and down the Texas coast all the time, you know, if I had sales calls from you know, 9 o'clock in the morning till noon, I'd go sneak out and fish from, you know, noon to 4 or 5. Only had, you know, either no kids or one kid at the time. So I'd go, you know, take a pair of shorts and my wading boots, and I'd go wade the flats for redfish or something. So I was always into the Orvis store, which was the Orvis store there in the Woodlands, Texas, which was kind of the closest place to my house down the road in the next town over. And I was always buying fly tying materials, and I kind of hated that job selling fiberglass grating. And I got to know the folks in the Orvis store, and they did not know this, but I had been fired from my job as a salesman only a few weeks before, because I got crossways with the boss. And I happened to go in there to the Orvis store to, I don't know, go buy some tinsel or some thread or something to tie some flies. And the guy, the manager of the store, said to me, he said, "Man, you're always in here. Would you like a job here?" And I thought he was kidding at first. And I said, "Oh, you know, real funny." And he was like, "No, seriously, we need a fishing manager in this store." He was a lifelong retail guy, but he didn't know the first thing about fishing. They didn't have anybody in there that could be kind of like a subject matter expert. And so they offered me a job. It ended up paying more money than I was making on the fiberglass grating sales job. It was closer to my house. And I didn't get to go fish during, you know, my regular sales trips, but I got a ton of opportunities. I mean, you know, that trip I took out there to Montana, that was a hosted trip. Orvis was a great company to work for, and they were a great company to sort of grow with. I ended up leaving them because I'd always had this desire to join the Marine Corps ever since I was a kid. And I realized after a few years of Orvis that I was 25 at that point. I had never, you know, sought out this goal. So I left Orvis and went off and joined the Marine Corps and spent 7 years doing that.
Wow. Interesting. And then let's get to where you are today. At the Rendezvous, you kind of gave me a synopsis of the company that you're with. Obviously there's a lot of crossover between fly angling and waterfowling. Tell me about G&H Decoys. Give me a little background on the history of this company and how you became involved with them.
Sure. So, G&H is the oldest manufacturer of a production waterfowl decoy in the United States of America. Company is 88 years old. We'll turn 89 this coming March. The company was founded by a man named John Gazalski, who started the company right after FDR signed the Duck Stamp Act. Which we all know created the duck stamp, but a less known fact is that the Duck Stamp Act made it illegal to use live birds as decoys. You know, you couldn't just tie a string on their leg anymore and put them out in front of you. And so John Gazalski, I think, saw an opportunity to – decoys have been around for centuries, millennia, I think. You know, I think cavemen first used decoys made out of straw or something to get ducks and geese to get close to them. So the decoy wasn't a new idea, but sort of mass producing decoys and making them affordably enough – for people to be able to buy was, I think, kind of a new idea in 1934. And when you really think about what Oklahoma was in 1934, it's kind of crazy that the business started here. We were like in the peak of the Dust Bowl days. This was before the New Deal. So we had literally zero lakes in Oklahoma. It was a big, wide open, dry piece of earth. And this guy had the idea to make decoys, and the company has persisted to this day. In Henrietta, where I'm sitting now as we record this podcast. So John's son, Dick, took the business over sometime in the 70s or 80s, I think. We're not really sure on exactly when. And Dick ran the business until he passed away in 2021. And it looked like the lawyers were just going to sort of chop the thing up for scrap and get rid of it. And so I kind of heard that it was maybe on the chopping block, and I put together a group of investors. And we bought the business, and I guess my title is the president and CEO, but I feel more like the chief cook and bottle wash.
Yeah.
It's been a lot of fun. Last week we added two more employees, and I think we're at 28 total employees now. We're growing like crazy, and we're the last company to produce a production quality waterfowl decoy here still in the United States. And we're very, very proud of that. So 120,000 square foot factory. We're back into Rogers Sporting Goods and Max Prairie Wings and a number of mom and pop stores across the region. Sportsman's Warehouse picked us up this year.
Oh, cool.
Go check your local Sportsman's Warehouse for our decoys. So we're just trying to put the business back in the place that it was when it sort of fell from grace in the 2000s as our economy kind of got its butt kicked by the Chinese. So.
And some of those 28 employees, were those was there a number of those folks that worked for the company originally that probably thought that they were out of a job? And
yeah, about half of them had worked at the company previously, and we had to go find those people. And that was one of the tough parts of restarting the business. We bought the business from Dick's estate, and then we just had an empty building. We had a lot of machinery and all the old molds and all those things. But we didn't even know how to turn the machines on because the instruction manuals were all gone. You know, there's a process for turning on a Natco B30 blow molder. You got to heat this up first and turn this on second. And we didn't know even how to do all that stuff. And we found the old general manager. I guess he was sort of still there at the business, kind of keeping the lights on, but nothing was going on there. And Derek, you know, kind of used his connections out in town to figure out where everybody was going. And Derek sort of put the band back together. At one point, you know, we went to go find a guy named Jeff Leslie, who's our shipping and outbound supervisor, and he was working at the Taco Bell. And Derek went up there and had to find him in person at the Taco Bell and said, "Hey, somebody bought the factory and we're turning it back on, and we'd really love you to come back." And I think Jeff told him, "Hey, wait there 1 minute." And Jeff went in the back and told his boss at the Taco Bell, like, "Hey, I quit," and walked out and came back to G&H. Unfortunately, you know, not a lot of jobs in this part of Oklahoma, and a lot of those folks had gone into fast food or were kind of between jobs. And so it was really cool to be able to see those people come back to something that they known and loved. I think our most tenured employee is a guy named Dennis Gooden, who's been here for 38 years, I think, if that's right. And he's a really interesting guy. He rides a bicycle to work every day. He's a widower. He's got six kids, and working at G&H is what he's done for most of his adult life, and it's what he loves. And, you know, he still runs in his 60s now, he still runs a blow molder every day.
Wow, that's cool, man. You got the band back together, and that's a really inspiring story. Is anybody that has a small business, you run into all sorts of hiccups all the time, and you know, you got to kind of find the inspiration once in a while to keep pushing on. And stories like this inspire someone like me, who's, you know, kind of still in the early stages of running a small business. It's like, well, hey, everybody that's done this has gone through a series of obstacles. You know, it's just like one big obstacle course that you have to learn to navigate and just keep pushing on. And I think, you know, more than anything, maybe perseverance is the most important quality you can have.
Yeah, you can appreciate it. Not every day is wonderful. Some days suck. Yeah. Our website went down yesterday, and that was not, you know, here we are in September on the eve before duck season in most of the country, and our website went down, and that was not a pleasant experience to have to deal with. But you're right. I mean, perseverance, right? You just got to keep your foot on the gas pedal and keep going.
Yeah, man, for sure. On another note, you're the father of six kids.
Yeah, Maggie and I have six kids. I don't know how that happened. Everybody always looks at you and they say, like, all six, like you, yeah, like us too, all six kids. I don't know how it happened. We got started kind of early in life, earlier than we anticipated. And we had one. She turned 16 back in July. She actually gets her driver's license this Friday. And I just don't know where the time has gone. But six kids, and not all of them love to hunt and fish. I'd be curious to know, you know, what your experience as a father is like. You love something so much. You love fly fishing, and you love, you know, I love duck hunting almost as much as I love fly fishing. But you love something so much, you want your kids to do it, but you don't want to force it on them because then they won't love it.
Right.
So, you know, like, My eldest daughter, my 16-year-old, she loves to go down to the river with me. She'll ride in the boat with me. She'll go to deer camp with me. She didn't have any interest in picking up a rod or shooting a gun. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm still trying to figure this out. But, you know, my sons, on the other hand, can't get enough of it. Henry, my 10-year-old, got an aquarium for his birthday, and he didn't want aquarium fish. He wanted me to drive him an hour and a half to the good smallmouth creek, and he wanted to fill the aquarium with smallmouth. So that's what we did. And so, you know, they love it and they can't get enough of it. But I'm still trying to figure out, like, how do you pass this on without some of them willingly love it and accept it, but some of them need a little more encouragement. And that's a piece I'm still trying to figure out.
Yeah. And I think that's a question that all of us parents that love the outdoors ask ourselves and struggle with. Cause you know, my kids are certainly interested in the outdoors. They ask about going hunting. Our son's 8 and our daughter's 5. So we're still a couple years away from hunting. But they both express interest in it, and they certainly like to go fishing. But, you know, it comes in small doses, right? If we go, I'm not going to go take them out on a 10-hour float.
Sure.
You know, I've been fortunately I've got a friend who has a little pond down the road that's stocked with big trout, and I've been taking them down there because we can go down there for an hour or two and they can catch fish, versus, you know, I'm not going to go take them fly fishing on the Blackfoot, for instance, yet. I guess for now I'm just kind of trying to introduce it in little increments and make it an experience that's enjoyable for everybody. My wife and I last.
Do you have Do you have fly rods in their hands, or do you start with conventional tackle?
Conventional tackle.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, my boy could, he could certainly learn how to fly cast, and he does fly cast a little bit. Like, he loves to go to the shows with us, and then he'll pick up a fly rod and, you know, start teaching people, which he's not qualified to do, but we're not going to deter his enthusiasm.
Sure.
But I don't know. I guess I kind of feel like I really took to fly fishing when I was probably 12-ish, I want to say. Mm-hmm. And I think like maybe that age, you kind of have, you know, more athletic ability and kind of all your faculties in place to pick it up and appreciate it and kind of learn everything about the sport. Because I just feel like when you're eight, you need instant gratification and, And, you know, he really loves to, they both love to throw a spinning rod around. So I'm just going to stick with that for now.
Yeah. I did the opposite. I guess I started my sons on fly tackle, and they can both throw a fly rod. In fact, a 10-year-old throws a fly rod better than his 13-year-old brother does. But they, I think this like desire to have something new and different, and they discovered like Texas rigging worms and, you know, all this different hardware stuff and all these different reels. And they just like, I turned my back on them for a second, and they've, you know, scrounged up their pocket money or mowed somebody's yard and gone and bought themselves a new rod and reel. And
That's cool.
You know, so they I'm not going to complain. I hope that someday they'll get into fly fishing with a little more fervor. I think they'll eventually come around on it. But right now they're crazy for hardware.
Well, nothing wrong with that. And you know,
catching fish is good.
Yeah. And you know, for our kids, it's they can have success with the spinning rod, you know, on their own, which is really fun to watch. So, we'll get there. I'm just going to kind of take it slowly and just try to make it as fun as possible for now and not force anything.
That's the key. Yeah.
Well, Ray, so the website for GNH is just GNHdecoys.com, right? That's the,
It's ghdecoys.com. We discovered early on that you can't put the ampersand symbol in a web address because it does some sort of computer code thing
and
sends you to the moon. But so it's ghdecoys.com is our website. On social media, we're only on. I can't bring myself to have the company do TikTok, but we're on Instagram and Facebook. So at ghdecoys on Instagram and Facebook. And we try not to take ourselves too seriously. I feel like so many people in the waterfowl industry just got to be so serious about it. Like, man, there's so much more to hunting, and it's the same thing for fishing. There's so much more to hunting than just a big pile of dead birds. There's a lot of experience in there that I think gets ignored and left behind. So we try not to take ourselves too seriously on social media, but go check us out. And we've got some cool things coming down the pipe later on this fall. We are doing a thing with BHA, but you know, Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, I think, is a great organization. That's kind of where you and I reconnected. We're doing a thing with them where every box of decoys that we sell from our website in the month of September comes with a free membership to BHA.
Oh, nice.
And then in six of those boxes between now and the end of September, we're going to put a golden duck in the box. And the golden duck is kind of like the Willy Wonka golden ticket. In December, we're going to host this big event with BHA where, in fact, you should think about coming down for it. We're going to host this big event. We're just calling it a duck camp on our front lawn in front of the factory. Go out, scout some public land, get back together that Friday evening, eat a little barbecue, and then get out Saturday morning and go hunt public land, and then come back Saturday afternoon and, you know, drink some beers and trade stories and let people show off that banded mallard that they shot. And the six lucky winners that got a golden duck, that entitles you to two free tickets to the event, and you'll get a tour of our factory. And then every single one of those six people is going to leave with an additional special prize that they'll find out about once they get here. It's not like Willy Wonka. Unfortunately, I'm not going to give the factory away to anybody, but it'll at least be a cool opportunity to peek behind the curtain and take something home that you can use for the rest of your life. So,
oh, that's super cool. That's a great idea, man. What a neat promotion. That's funny you said that, because as soon as you said the Golden Duck, Willy Wonka immediately popped in my head. So
yeah, that's awesome. Not going to lie that we shamelessly ripped off that idea.
Yeah, that's cool. That's clever, man. That's awesome. So the tarpon that you hooked on the 8-weight. Now, I want to get back to that real quickly. Were you worried that rod was going to break? I mean, a 65-pound tarpon is nothing to sneeze at. I know everyone's like, oh, sure, you know, 200-pound tarpon. I'm into the giant tarpon thing, but like,
sure.
You've ever caught a 60-pound tarpon, they are a load on a 12-weight. So,
I was, you know, admittedly, it was no Andy Mill 215-pound fish. But it was in a kayak, especially in a kayak with an 8-weight. I was a little bit worried that the rod was going to break. I was more worried that the thing I was most worried about was that I wasn't going to land the fish and I was going to exhaust it and kill it. That's what I was worried about. I knew from a couple of times when the fish kind of beached for air, I knew that the fish was well hooked. The hook wasn't going to come undone. We could see that the thing was hooked square on the inside of the top of the mouth, and we felt like we had him, you know, hooked pretty good. I was worried that the fish was going to get exhausted and I wouldn't be able to get that hook out of his mouth and die. We spent probably 20 minutes reviving that fish and making sure that it was healthy before we turned it loose. But it was exhausting. I think I had that fish on the line for, I don't know, I guess Keenan could probably speak to it. I probably had that fish on the line for 40 minutes. And Keenan's comment to me, and he is absolutely right, is like, man, next time bring a 10-weight for that fish.
And yeah,
he's not right. Like, that's more fair to the fish. And I probably will bring it. Probably prudent to have, you know, even for a 65-pound fish, it might not kill you to have an 11 or 12-weight in the boat with you, just to help you get it done faster. So.
Right. But you weren't necessarily expecting to run into a tarpon of that size, right? You were kind of thinking more.
No,
like,
we thought we were going to look for the 10 to 20 pounders that live back up in the mangroves. And these big fish started to roll out in the middle of the channel. And I just got a crazy idea to, you know, I wonder if I can get one to eat.
Well, yeah, you got to throw the fly at them.
Right. You go that way, go that far, you know, you got to try it.
So I've never kayak fished like that, for tarpon.
Yeah.
What's it like fighting the fish from a kayak, and how did you land it?
It was a rolling catastrophe for the entire time. It was a pretty stable kayak. It was fish swimming around and underneath the boat. You know, you've had big fish on that want to go under a bigger boat. And if you've got enough space and you're standing up, you can walk around the edges of the boat and you can kind of manage that operation. But when your butt is planted in the boat and you can't really turn around in the boat either, you've got to figure out how to like pass your rod behind you. I think at one point I had the fish like turning to go behind me and headed into the mangroves. And I had to kind of hand Keenan the rod for a second so I could flip the boat around and take the rod back from him. So poor Keenan didn't get to fish for the entire time that I was trying to land this big kid. But, it was a wild adventure. It was a ton of fun. And, you know, had I to do all that over again, I'd rather have a skiff and a 12-weight, or at least a 10-weight. But, you know, makes for a great story.
No doubt. Well, you did it the hard way, man. So good on you. Just like G&H decoys is doing things the hard way too. But that's the way that they always did it. And really cool that you're keeping that legacy alive. Thanks again for taking the time to join me. And it's ghdecoys.com. Your Instagram handle too is Pennyflies, right?
Pennyflies, that's me. Yep, at Pennyflies.
Cool. So we can learn more about Ray and G&H Decoys in those two spots. And man, I appreciate you taking the time and cannot wait to reconnect with you somewhere, preferably in Puerto Rico, chasing tarpon out of a kayak. That sounds like like a
blast.
Yeah,
I'm gonna send you a text after we get off here, and we really should think about maybe a midsummer. You tell me when your low season is, when you can get time to go down there, and I'll show you the local flavor. We'll eat in all the local holes. We'll go drink beer in the local dive bars, and we'll go catch the local fish.
Go to thefebruaryroom.com, where you can access a complete library of our podcast and read more about our guests, their fishing stories, and favorite fly patterns. We're always looking for exceptional fly fishing yarns, and if you have one to spin, shoot us an email at info@thefebruaryroom.com. The February Room is always free, but if you feel like throwing a nickel in the pond, we appreciate any additional listener support. For companies and individuals interested in sponsorship opportunities, please contact us for our media kit. Thanks for stopping by the February Room, and we'll see you down here next week.